You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And what a beautiful day it is in Washington, D.C. It started raining. Hey, it's a nice thing in large parts of the world. They would give a lot for that in Los Angeles right now. And much of the rest of California. And greetings to the folks in our chat room as I resize my window here, my window with Sue in it, and my window in the chat room. Great to see you all. Well, it is my birthday today. And because it's my birthday, my driver's license expired. And because my driver's license expired, you know, if you go in the day after your driver's license expires, you have to take the driving test all over again. It's like you never had a driver's license, at least in some states. I don't know if it's that way here in D.C., but I'm, you know, I got caught in that trap in one of the states that I lived in once. And I don't remember if it was Vermont or New Hampshire or Michigan, wherever it was. And I just swore I'm never going to do that again. And so my driver's license expired today, and so I went down to the DMV. And the reason I'm telling you this story is because the primaries elections in North Carolina just started, and those people are now exposed to these new voter ID laws. And the and Michigan now has new voter ID laws, and Wisconsin, I think, has been enjoined, has been stopped, and Florida, but they're trying. And, you know, Alec is pushing these things, right? Paul Weyrich famously said, you know, I don't want everybody to vote. In fact, you have to saw it. Hey, I don't have to say it. Here's Paul Weyrich saying it.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So this is the guy who was running the Reagan campaign and who co-founded the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is pushing out legislation now to basically do the modern version of literacy tests. Literacy tests used to be you'd show up to vote, and if you were white, they would say, who's the president of the United States? And you'd say, Dwight Eisenhower. And they'd say, okay, cool, you can vote. And if you were black and you showed up, they'd say, okay, literacy test, please recite word for word the Gettysburg Address. And if you could pull that off, then they'd say, please recite the Constitution. I mean, you know, it was just like it was impossible. And so why am I saying this? What does this have to do with my birthday? I got up early this morning. I woke up at 7:30 this morning, which is really early for me because, I mean, we don't even get off the air until 8 o'clock. I don't get home typically until 9, 9:30. We have dinner. We set up the next morning's show. Louise, my work day is typically done around 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and we usually get to sleep around midnight. And I woke up this morning, 7:30, because I wanted to get over and get my driver's license and get it done with because our first show prep meeting is at 11:15 in the morning. We have a conference call with six people on it. And long before that, we've got to have our wiki filled out. We've got to have our page filled out with all the suggestions and ideas. And we've got to go through all the news stories and get ready for the day. That's for the TV show. And then the radio show comes at noon, 45 minutes later. So I thought, okay, the DMV opens at 8:45 or 8:30, and I looked up the Washington, D.C. DMV page to find out what I needed to get a driver's license or to renew my driver's license in D.C. And which I really don't even need. I mean, I don't own a car. I haven't driven a car in years. When I'm out of town, I take taxis. When I'm in D.C., I either take the metro, or if it's really raining and a terrible day, I take Uber. And I walk a lot, and it's wonderful. My blood pressure's gotten normal. But in any case, I digress. What I went through this morning to get my driver's license is what people in these voter ID states are going to go through if they don't have voter ID and they don't already have a driver's license, and hundreds of thousands of them in each one of these states, several hundred, at least 200,000 in Wisconsin, at least 600,000 in North Carolina, don't have because, like me, they live in an urban area and they don't own a car, so why bother getting a driver's license? Or they're poor enough that they are, you know, there's no chance they're ever going to own a car. Or they live in an urban area and don't need a car. Or they're disabled, or they're elderly, or they're college students. So they don't, you know, so they've got to go through. So you could, the form that I filled out, you had two little boxes at the top. One said driver's license. The other said government-issued ID. So the requirements were identical. And I had read the requirements on the website when I was looking at what time the office opened. And I read it, and it said, you know, you've got to prove your Social Security number, and you've got to have two proofs of where you live and some proof that you actually are a citizen of the United States. And so I pulled together my driver's license, which expired today, or expires tomorrow, I guess. Expires at midnight tonight. Got my driver's license. I got my passport. I got my pilot's license. Now, your pilot's license ID number is your Social Security number, so it has my Social Security number on it. I got my credit card statement from my bank, and it's one of the, I mean, you can't get a credit card from a little bank these days anyway. It's but the main one that we use for the company was the one I got, and it's from one of the big banks, I'm embarrassed to admit. But anyhow, it's a credit card statement. And I got my utility bill and my slip rental bill for the boat for living down in the marina. I thought, okay, I got everything I need. And so I go down to the DMV, and the first person, and I stand in line for 20, 30 minutes, and finally, and it wasn't too bad. Finally, I get up there, and the guy goes through everything, and he says, you know, your pilot's licenses and your passport are not proof of your Social Security number. You actually have to show us a Social Security card or a tax return, a W-2 or a 1099 that has your Social Security number on it. Nothing else will work. So, you know, I live about 10 or 12 blocks from this place, about a mile away. So I walked back home and rummaged through my drawers and found my Social Security card, which I had gotten reissued when we lived in Portland back 5 years ago, because I had lost the one I got when I was 15 years old, and went back the second time. Second time, another half hour in line, get up there, they look at it. My Social Security card only has one N on the end of my name, Hartman. The person who reissued it at the Social Security office screwed it up. I know that the Social Security office has it right. I get the statements. I know the IRS has it right. The card was wrong. So they said, yeah, this won't work. Do you have anything else with your Social Security number on it? Oh, I got my pilot's license, so that doesn't work. So I went back home and came back with something with my Social Security number on it. Then the question was, your residence. And so I said, well, here's my bank statement. And the woman said, this is a credit card statement, not a bank statement. And I said, it says right there, Bank of America, or whatever the name of the bank is. I don't want to name the bank, but the word bank is part of the name of the bank. And it said bank, and in big letters at the top, it says statement. And she said, I know the difference between a credit card statement and a bank statement, and this is a credit card statement, not a bank statement. And apparently you don't know the difference, and you can go home and get your bank statement and figure it out. I mean, pretty much just like that. So I went home and I got a bank statement, and I came back for the fourth time to the DMV. Now, just imagine, this is not people trying to keep me from getting a driver's license.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is just, you know, people doing their jobs as well they think they should. Can you imagine, though, if I was in mostly white Lansing, Michigan, and I was black and I was trying to get an ID to vote? And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Andrew Campbell is with us, senior producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Wide majorities losing faith in John Roberts' Supreme Court.
Yeah, there's a new study out. It really shouldn't be much of a surprise to us considering the recent corporate-friendly decisions that the Roberts Court handed down. In fact, the Roberts Court is the most corporate-friendly court since at least World War II, according to a study from the Minnesota Law Review.
Yeah.
And it looks like Americans are catching on to the conflicts of interest and the personal and political ideologies that might be going into some of these opinions. So we're going to be talking about that and leaning off the rumble with what's wrong with reforming the Supreme Court, whether that means putting in sensible reforms like term limits, making justices disclose their financial conflicts of interest, et cetera.
At least holding them to the standards of federal judges. They are federal judges, after all, and they have exempted themselves from the federal judicial rules of code of conduct.
Right.
And really, Congress, I mean, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution explicitly gives Congress that power, not the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. It's time something changed on the bench.
This should be entertaining. So Horace Cooper and Kevin Martin are going to be on with us.
Yep, should be an entertaining one. We're going to be moving on from the court discussion to talking about a new report out that says a majority of America's millionaires are in favor of taxing the rich. Just think how our economy could flourish and how the working class could flourish if we just bumped up taxes a little bit for the wealthiest Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about anything extraordinary here.
Right.
It just seems like the right thing to be doing and the sensible thing. We'll move on to talk a little bit about Benghazi and the millions of dollars it will cost for John Boehner to put his select Benghazi committee into action. And also look at why none of these special committees were formed during the 12 embassy bombings under the Bush administration.
Right. In fact, I've got a printout around here, 13 of them, actually. And, you know, if we had that printout, it's if you don't have it, let me know and I'll get it to you. But January 22nd, 5 people killed in Calcutta, India. June 14th, 2002, Karachi, Pakistan, 12 people killed. 51 injured. October 12, 2002, Indonesia, no fatalities. February 28, 2003, 2 people are killed. I mean, all I would have to do, I think, is just read this list to them.
Yeah, it really speaks for itself.
Let them try to yell over
it. Where was the endless outrage then?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, there was none.
Exactly. We'll also talk about Charlie Crist saying he left the Republican Party because of its inherent racism.
Yep.
And we'll finish up talking about Elizabeth Warren has an interesting new proposal to help combat the student loan debt epidemic right now.
Cool. You know, I've got Charlie Crist was on our radio show a while back, and there's a clip on YouTube of him on this show. And I think that he said that same thing on this show. I know he talked about how corrupt the Republican Party had become.
Right.
So if you're looking for a site, you might want to check that out.
Okay, then in Block D, we have Alex Lorzon. He is with young people. He's basically with a group. It's a young Americans, millennial generation, and a little older that have sued the federal government over climate change. And they're actually making some traction. So it's really interesting to see what the younger generation is doing to help save our planet.
Right. There you go. Okay. Andrew Campbell. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you tonight. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harmon here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. You know, my experience at the DMV, it's interesting. I didn't end the story. After the fourth time when I went back, I now had my bank statement. I now had my tax statement. I now, you know, everything conceivable, right? I had this pile of paper. And going back for the fourth time, and we're 3 hours into this now. If I was not my own employer, you know, my boss can't fire me because I'm my boss. But, you know, 3 hours out of work, really? I think at least halfway through, maybe the second, third, fourth time, I would have said, screw it. If I'm just trying to do this to get an ID to vote, screw it. I need to go back to, you know, drywalling the, you know, houses or whatever I do for a living, you know. So finally, the fourth time I got there, I got sent to a fourth person, a very nice guy. Actually, the first one was a man. The second, third were a woman. The fourth was a guy. Not that that has anything to do with it, but very nice guy who said, I just thought I would just try it out. I see what happened. So I gave him my passport and my Social Security card with my name misspelled on it. And he said, oh, your Social Security card is, they dropped the N on, the second N on your name. And I said, yeah, I got it reissued when I was in Portland, and I think the clerk just wasn't paying attention. But, you know, the Social Security office has it right because they, you know, they stopped sending those statements out a couple years ago, but they always had them everything right. And, you know, they take my taxes every year. And he laughed and he said, I'm sure they do. No problem for him. And then I handed him my credit card statement and said, here's my bank statement to show that I actually live where I live, and here's my utility bill. And he said, okay, fine. And, you know, I gave my old driver's license, and he copied the information off and said, is this all right? And I said, yes. And he took my credit card, and I paid my $35 for a new driver's license and took a picture and did the vision test, and that was it. It was all done. It was all nice, and I didn't need any of the stuff that I'd gone back for three times. Now, in a way, this illustrates the danger of the arbitrary power of government, although, frankly, it's arbitrary power anywhere. I mean, I've had these kinds of very, very frustrating conversations where you get three different answers from three different people with health insurance companies probably 40 or 50 times in my life. I've had conversations like this with banks over the years. I have had particularly mortgage brokers. Oh, you need to, we needed that, not that, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, and I'd say probably about half the people who were in front of me in line, maybe two thirds of the people in front of me in line, got turned away because they didn't meet some criteria. Just like I got turned away three out of four times, or, you know, three times, and then finally the fourth time, I just gave him what I had originally come with, and he took it. So there's a certain amount of arbitrary power or decision-making capability, latitude inherent in any kind of bureaucracy, whether it's the phone company or whether it's the DMV. But here's the thing that really baffles me. After we were all done, he scanned all the documents I brought. So the DMV now has, using their old Windows computers, in fact, the screen in the waiting room had Internet Explorer on it, which the Department of Homeland Security says don't use, and it had a little thing down in the right-hand corner that said there are updates available for this computer. I mean, it was right on the monitor that was telling us, you know, what time of day it was, and welcome to the DMV. They have scanned my credit card record, my tax statement, my bank statement. Well, that's my credit card. We didn't get to the bank statement. My driver's license, my passport. All of this stuff is now sitting in a government computer. And so I'm thinking, if I was a Republican, how do you play this thing? Right? We don't want people to vote. So we're going to force them into the DMV, knowing that everybody hates the DMV. It's a bureaucracy. It's slow. It's a hassle. I mean, actually, you know, the fourth person I've worked with there and the first were very nice. Only one out of the four was even slightly discourteous. And she was only discourteous when I told her, I tried to assert to her that my credit card statement was a bank statement because it said statement in big letters at the top and it said bank in big letters at the top and she was having none of it. And I think she thought I was talking back to her and, you know, how it goes. But anyhow, so if you don't want people to vote, force them into the DMV first. Number one barrier. But then you get into one of these weird arguments that's kind of like the death penalty argument. Because rich white guys have to go to the DMV, too, to get their ID. And the DMV is now storing all your personal information on a computer that's a government computer. Do you really want that done? It's sort of like, you know, if you don't trust the government, if you don't trust the post office, if you don't trust the DMV, if you don't trust, then why would you trust capital punishment? It turns out 1.6% of the time the person killed is completely innocent. 4.5% of the time the person convicted and sentenced to death is completely innocent. the difference between the two are the, in part, the ones where the guilt is ultimately questioned to the point where the person isn't executed. But it seems to me, having been through this, and now, you know, what's 400 to 600,000 people in North Carolina are going to have to go through this in order to get a government-issued ID. And a couple hundred thousand people in Michigan are going to have to go through this if they want to vote. I'm getting it. What a slick trick the Republicans have pulled off on this thing. You know? Yeah. Somebody wants to vote. We don't want them to vote. Hey. Send him to the DMV first.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what, you know, to add insult to injury, the voting fraud is a crime that just doesn't happen. You're more likely to die from the television falling on your head than to commit voter fraud. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, TuneIn Radio, TuneIn is relaunching their app today. They have a number of new social features that let people share and save and engage, and 45 million active monthly users. So the Progressive Voices channel and Free Speech TV, and we're live on the radio, but on TuneIn, it's the Progressive Voices channel. So you can check that out. Brand new app. And, of course, there's the Tom Hartman app, just FYI. All free, as far as I know. I mean, our app is free. So, anyhow, Bruce in Arvada, Colorado. Hey, Bruce. Thanks for listening to AM 760.
Good afternoon. Take you off speakerphone there.
Thank you.
I don't know where to go with this one. I listened to your rant about the DMV, and I'm thinking, where's he going with this one? I must have been off my game. My first reaction as I was listening to the first few minutes of this was, man, this just typifies a government-run operation. And in the I'm off my game category, I couldn't figure out how this would connect to evil Republicans.
Well, it's not just government-run. It's a bureaucracy. Have you not ever in your life had the exact same problem trying to deal with a department store return department or a phone company, a billing department or a health insurance company that insists you didn't pay when you did or what? I mean, you know, this is just the nature of bureaucracy. It doesn't have to be government
bureaucracies, but I will add on to that my experience is that one can expect this type of conduct in government bureaucracies in spades. Look what's happening at the VA right now. Secretary Shinseki, who I think arguably is a good guy, is under fire because the bureaucracy that works under him failed veterans. We all have stories about DMVs. We avoid them like the plague. Here's a government bureaucracy.
You know, there's a couple before. You know, hang on just a second, Bruce. You mentioned the VA, and I can't just let that pass without pointing out what Senator Sanders has pointed out. He's the head of the VA committee in the Senate. And at number one, in the last couple of years, they've managed to cut the wait times in half, but they're still terrible. I mean, people are still waiting to have, you know, up to a year to get benefits that they should get the day after they get out, number one. But number two, George W. Bush took us into two wars, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and appropriated, guess how many dollars he appropriated for the Veterans Administration to deal with these people coming home during those 8 years? How many dollars did the George W. Bush administration or Bush himself ever ask for the VA? You know the number?
I said, I have no idea.
The number is zero.
Tell me.
The number is zero.
I doubt it. But
the number is zero.
I'll stipulate because I don't have the number in front of me.
Those wars were both off the books. There was never any appropriation for any aspect of them whatsoever. And the consequence of that,
paid for. Therefore, they are on the books. That's a meme.
And Obama put them on the books when he came into office. Yeah, and it immediately
on the, okay.
But the point is that the VA got caught flat footed by these two wars, and they also got flat footed by their own decision to start actually doing what they should have done 30 years ago, and that is honor the Agent Orange requests from the Vietnam era, and they're trying to make a computer transition. And you're right. It's a bureaucracy. It's a bureaucracy. I mean, it's just like I said, just like in corporations. But that's,
I have to admit, I'm pretty impressed that you've managed to transfer, with my facilitation, the DMV bureaucracy to the VA bureaucracy. You've managed to divert the issue of the point.
Well, I didn't bring up the VA. You did.
You're right. Like I said, with my facilitation.
Okay.
Bad on me. Let me give you one in terms of bureaucracy. Here in Colorado, we can renew our driver's license online. You live in D.C., correct, in the District of Columbia, right?
Right.
Okay. Strongly Democratic, strongly left of center government, correct?
No, actually, the problem with the government here in D.C. No, hang on just a second. You don't understand. D.C. really doesn't. D.C. doesn't have a government. For example, D.C. just decriminalized pot, right? It won't become law, even though the city council voted on it and the mayor signed it. It won't become law until Congress acts on it. Nothing happens in D.C. until Congress acts on it. And so if D.C. wants to, for example, upgrade their DMV to have online sign-ons, it has to be passed through Darrell Issa's committee. Ain't happening. No money for D.C. Anything D.C. wants to do, the Republicans in Congress automatically block. They've been doing this for 30 years.
Boy, I have really failed here. I have really failed. I have
managed
to facilitate.
I'm telling you, I live in D.C. I know this. I mean, I just, you know, it's okay. I'm watching it every day. It's very frustrating to me. I think D.C. should become its own state. There's 800,000 people in this city. That's more than, it's more than Vermont. That's more than Oklahoma. I mean, you know, we should have two senators, and Eleanor Holmes Norton should be able to vote. And we should be able to, you know, tax ourselves. And I mean, our license plates say taxation without representation, you know.
I'll let you go in just a moment, but I will point out what you just said.
Yes, sir.
You just said that D.C. has no government, and then you immediately said the mayor and the city council, and then...
And Eleanor Holmes Norton, and they're all relatively impotent.
By definition, they do have a government.
Well, yeah, if a government...
Oh, yeah, that's...
No. Hang on just a second. If a government can govern, can actually make final decisions for its people... There is no government in D.C. If a government has positions that are called mayor and city council and can make recommendations to another government, the United States Congress, and requests of another government, may we please have a budget, sir, then, yes, we do have a government. So it's a matter of semantics.
So I expect that you will go right out after the show and try to lobby for online driver's license.
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love it.
So you're going to do that?
They just did this with our boats. You know, I live in a boat in the marina down here, and the it used to be the last 2 years because you have to re-register your boat every year, and the last 2 years I had to go to the police department in person to register the boat, and it was just like going to the DMV. It's not anywhere near as bad actually because there's no line, you know, and you know I know the woman there, and you know it's far more casual and informal, but it's still, you know, you got to show up in person. This year they put it online, and the implementation was sort of like Obamacare. I mean, you know, it didn't work for months and months, and so they had to move back the date by about 3 months by which you had to have the new sticker on your boat. You know, but at least they did it, and they're working on it. But it took them years to get Congress to approve that, and I think it might be that that's not – well, actually it is, yeah, because it's the police department of D.C. that's supervising it. So, yeah, that came through the D.C. budget somehow. But, yeah, I think they should do it with driver's licenses. I would love it.
Okay. You're apt to make specious arguments. You've made a couple of them today.
I don't think they're specious.
You successfully diverted the point that I was trying to make, whether valid or invalid.
The point you were trying to make is the government bureaucracies are nasty, and I agree with you.
And
that's why I don't want government bureaucrats listening to my email. I don't want them, you know, listening to my phone calls, reading my email. I don't... You know, I'm so offended by these Fourth Amendment violations. I don't want government bureaucrats. I want a judge and jury deciding who's going to get blown up with a drone, who's going to be executed.
That's why I was confused on where to go with this one, because you were talking about.
It's because you're trying to be partisan, and I'm trying to be true to principle here rather than party. The Democratic Party is just as bad as the Republican Party on this stuff.
Okay.
except for D.C. The Republicans are really out to screw D.C. because it's historically been a Democratic and largely black city. There's a long history of that. And it was probably Democrats trying to screw D.C. back when the Democrats before the 50s and the 60s when the Democrats were the racist, the Dixiecrats. But anyhow, Bruce, thank you for the good try. Good try. Anytime. Welcome to call. We'll do it again. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
This is regard to corporate control. We know it's all out of whack. And you mentioned Mondragon on a show last night when you were talking to Richard Wolff, which was a cooperative system.
Yes.
And there are other alternatives like the German code determination, which may not be as good as Mondragon, but it's a step forward.
You're right.
The point I want to make, though, is that it's likely because of the monarchs we call the court system in the United States that it would never fly. Mm-hmm. Because in the United States, corporations, in addition to be treated as people, there's a contradiction because a person doesn't have to maximize his profits. Corporations by law do.
Did you know that there are more people in the United States who are employees and owners of employee-owned corporations or cooperatives than there are union members?
I'm not surprised, but no, I didn't.
So it is flying here, and it is growing here, actually. It's just it's still small.
The
unions are 7%.
I'm talking about corporations like in Germany, 2,000 or more employees.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's part of the German Constitution. I mean, that's something that Harry Truman talked him into.
Did that. So if we the corporations of that size, like General Motors, this is Dodge versus General Motors, which
right.
has never been overthrown, have to maximize their profits. So as soon as the United States passes a law that says that the workers get 50% control, what happens is it gets ruled unconstitutional.
Yeah. Meanwhile, actually it wouldn't, because that was only in the Michigan Supreme Court. It never went to the federal Supreme Court, A. And B, it was Dodge v. Ford, just FYI. But your point that the German Constitution requires any company with over 1,000 employees to have half of hanging to
say. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Maybe it's 2,000 employees, but whatever. To have half of its board of directors made up of representatives of the unions within that corporation is working so well in Germany. It's an excellent point. Thank you, Mike. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes before the hour. And Catherine, watch it on Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, you wanted to talk about the DMV?
Hi, how are you? You know, it's more insidious what they're doing with the DMVs. Here in Wisconsin, in the rural areas, they're closing them and cutting down hours.
Yes.
So you get a person who's working, a minimum wage job, if they're lucky enough to work, then they have to get somebody to drive them. So that's probably two workers, plus you have the gas money. And then what happened to you when you get there?
Right. And it will almost certainly.
I think it was back in January of this year, Christie, in what they felt was an act of political revenge, closed the fourth largest DMV in New Jersey in Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And they always claim cost-saving measures when they do this.
And they always do it by coincidence just after they pass voter ID laws.
Yeah. I mean, we had so much going on here. When the voter ID law was stayed, and we had, and it was the recall election, I was in the main library was in an annex because the main one was being refurbished. And I went in there and I saw the flyers that said that you needed voter ID to vote. And so I went up to the research librarian and I said, what are these doing here? Because it had been weeks since the stay.
Right.
And she said, we didn't put them out. They actually, I believe, went around and put back out that the voter ID needed to still be used.
Oh, down south in the 2012 election, I forget the group, and I don't know if it was Koch Brothers affiliated or somebody else, but there was a group that was putting up billboards that showed a picture of a black person behind bars and said, it is a crime for which you can go to jail to vote if you are not properly registered. And it was in Ohio. Thank you, Shane. Shane just Googled it while I was discussing
that's one, but we had something like that. You know,
and it was just designed to scare people, people who are registered to vote. They would think, well, maybe I'm not properly registered.
Oh, yeah, it's total misinformation. And the other thing that's going on, and because it's really not the Republican Party, they're the lackeys. It's Alec that's writing this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And now they're going after local control. They're going after city councils and board of boards, education boards. They don't want any of that in local control.
That's right.
So when are we going to start calling it what it really is?
Fascism.
They're melting down the United States.
Yeah, they are. They are. It is the corporate control of government, which is Mussolini's definition of fascism, the merger of corporate and state interests.
Exactly.
And it is a sad day in America, and it has been facilitated by five people on the U.S. Supreme Court who have decided that they are the kings of this country. And I say kings because all five of them are men, and that they have created a law that did not exist, that money is protected by the First Amendment, and they created another law that didn't exist. It's never been voted on by any legislature or signed by any president or governor that corporations are protected under the 14th Amendment. They invented this stuff out of whole cloth, and the consequence of it is this massive transfer of wealth and power from we the people, average working people, and by power, I mean things like the right to unionize, for example, or the right to start a small business, whatever it may be, you know, to not be squashed like a bug by a giant monopoly. They have transferred that wealth and power from we the people to the billionaires and the transnational corporations. And I think we are hitting a breaking point, Catherine. I think we are on the verge of really substantial societal and political change. Thank you for the call. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Rick in Las Vegas, you wanted to, you have an interesting DMV story?
Yes. Tom, are you there?
I am. You're on the air.
Okay. You were talking about identity problems when you go in for driver's license and such things. I went through a two-year period where the federal government, state government, county government, banking, and every entity that I had to deal with, I was not a legal resident because they refused to put junior at the end of my name. And when they punched up my Social Security number, they got my father's Social Security number instead of mine.
Wow.
For 2 years, I was, and I'll leave you to comment on that.
Well, it's just, I mean, these are the kind of things that happen. And you know, my point, I mean, bureaucracies are a necessary evil. But for Republicans as a strategy to discourage people from voting, what they've done is they've gone from the old literacy tests, where, you know, if you were white and you showed up and they'd say, who's president of the United States? And I think I said this earlier, and you'd say, you know, Dwight Eisenhower. And if you were black and showed up, they say, okay, literacy test, recite for me the Declaration of Independence. And they've gone from literacy tests now to the DMV. I mean, you know, they always figure out something to throw in front of people, particularly minorities and poor people, to make it harder for them to vote. And that's what they're doing. And I think your story is just another illustration of, you know, the frustration of dealing with bureaucracies. And it's why the Republicans aggressively are pushing to insert a bureaucracy between voters and the ballot box. Rick, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Randall in Oceanside, California. You wanted to comment on my lack of common sense?
Well, yeah, just real quick. I got a couple of things to cover with you. First off is here in California, you can renew your driver's license up to 6 months before your birthday. You don't have to wait for the last day.
Oh, I know. I could have done it before. It's just if you knew my schedule, there were so many, in fact, the DMV here is open on Saturdays, and there have been so many Saturdays where I got up and said to Louise, okay, let's go down and do my driver's license. And, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Secondly, I had a similar situation with my Social Security card, and I took my certified birth certificate down to the Social Security card office here, and I had to wait like maybe 45 minutes, saw the lady, showed them the typo, and they issued me a new card. I got it in the mail in like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, I need to do that. You know, it's just... Yeah.
And also, I'd like to say something on a personal matter about living in a Republican world. Can I do that?
Sure.
Anyway, I live here in California. Mm-hmm. And before, and I don't know when it was changed because I do vote, so I don't remember seeing anything on the ballot about this. It used to be if you worked for an employer for 2 years, they had to have just cause to fire you. But apparently now they got what's called work at will. And I worked for this company for 13 years, spotless record. Mm-hmm. The father gave the business to his son, and his son subsequently fired me because he was forcing his employees to work off the clock, punch out, and go back to work
right.
for free,
right.
and I refused. And I thought I was living in America.
Yeah.
But apparently it went through, and I complained. I went to the Labor Commission. They didn't really do much of an investigation about it. I wrote letters to the state attorney general, which informed me that they would not do anything against another state agency and that I should get a lawyer.
Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunate, and you know, it's this kind of, I guess, falls into the category of stuff that happens. In large part, Randall, what you are seeing is the consequence of Ronald Reagan's war on labor. We used to have a tight labor market. You go back and you read newspapers and articles and stories, short stories from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. People would, you know, leave their hometowns and go off to some other town just confident that they'd get a job. They'd go to college in another town figuring, you know, hey, I'll get a job, nothing to worry about. And now, because, you know, we've lost 50,000 factories in the last 10 years, you know, so 32 years of Reaganomics has hollowed out the middle class and hollowed out the power of the middle class along with it. The labor market is so loose, it's so flaccid right now that employers hold all the cards. And you've got among them some unscrupulous employers who use that power to screw their employees. And tragically, you're one of them. Randall, thanks for sharing your story, and I appreciate the call. Jay in Tucson, you actually have a nice DMV there?
Hi there. Yeah, I got some compliments. But I do want to say that first, Americans for Prosperity is a misnomer and should be referred to as Americans for the Prosperous.
Yeah, exactly.
Because these people need to be protected from...
Yeah, well, that's what it is. It really is.
Let's talk about Americans for the Prosperous.
Yeah.
Now, I live in Tucson, which is, some people call it the Berkeley of Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and I think of it as the Austin of Arizona.
Yeah, I love
it
Tucson.
It is an awfully nice town.
It is.
But, yeah. But a number of years ago, and I'm thinking 15 or 20 years ago, they revamped the DMV,
mm-hmm.
and it's awfully good.
Yeah.
It's
the one in Oregon is awfully good, too, but in Oregon, they're not trying to do voter ID laws. You know, in Wisconsin, they pass a voter ID law, and then they close the local DMV offices, so everybody has to do three times as much work, and guess what happens?
Well, here, it's amazing that one, you said I stood in line.
Mm-hmm.
We don't stand. We're given a number, and there's lots of chairs.
Yeah, well, I did that, actually. That's how it works here.
Little
yeah.
comfort things going on.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
I want to talk about is that recently I got a ticket that I deserved, and it was one of the cameras that caught me.
Oh, yeah.
So here we're given the option, if you haven't had a ticket in X number of years, you get to sort of negate the bad part of this by taking... driving.
Jay, I'm sorry, we're out of time. You're going to have to call me later on and finish that story another time. Okay? Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And speaking of justice and injustice, Frank Coughlin is with us. He is the representative of the Justice for Sicily Support Group, Justice for CECILY.com. And Frank, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me on.
Good. It's good, and you're welcome. Tell us who Cecily McMillan is and why we should care.
Yeah, and thanks for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Cecily. Cecily McMillan is an Occupy Wall Street activist, among many other things, being very involved in labor organizing, student organizing, was involved in the Wisconsin protests of 2011. And is also, you know, in between all of her activism, working on her master's at the New School right now, and currently preparing herself for a life of community organizing. And the reason that people should know about her is that most people who are on the left are aware she was just convicted on Monday of assault in the second degree of an NYPD officer for a crime that is she is accused or now committed or convicted of having committed on March 17, 2012, the six-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And why people should care about this case, among many other things, is that this is essentially a civil liberties case, and that now our suspected or supposed right of having peaceful protests, our right to peacefully assemble, is being chipped away. And many, many of us in activist circles believe that this is a large, large hit against our civil liberty to peacefully protest against injustices that we see in the system and injustices that we see on a daily occurrences here.
Yeah, we had Chris Hedges on about this.
Sexually assaulted and then charged with assault against an officer.
Yeah, my understanding is what happened, and we had Chris Hedges on talking about this, and he was pointing out that around the country, Occupy protesters are being prosecuted for felonies and then given long probation periods, which essentially forbids them from ever being activists again. Plus, they've got a felony on their record, which makes them ineligible for certain scholarships and lots of different types of jobs and all kinds of awful things. But my understanding is that what happened here is this woman was in this Occupy protest. A cop walked up behind her, grabbed her breast, apparently roughly enough to leave a bruise. And in reaction to that, she spun around and raised her elbow, and it hit him in the face. Is that an accurate description of what happened? I believe it's on videotape.
Yeah, and you know, the only incongruency with that is that she didn't spin around. Her breast was grabbed from behind by this cop who was wearing his police jacket inside out with no hat. And so it was not very obvious that he was an NYPD officer. She was leaving the park, following orders from another officer, texting on her phone, having been charged with nothing prior to this, not engaging any type of protest, peaceful or not, on that day, leaving the park as ordered. The officer came up, grabbed her breast, and she reacted as I think most people would react when being groped like that. She swung her arms back in kind of a surprised manner and hit the officer in the face.
Right.
And then he proceeded to beat her on the ground until she went into a seizure.
Wow. And she is the one who was prosecuted for assault, and she is the one who was convicted and is facing 7 years. And this officer, who has a history of violence against people, is unaffected by this, apparently.
Completely unaffected. And he actually has three cases against him of suspected police violence.
So
were not allowed in the courtroom.
So this is
the jury because it was deemed irrelevant.
Now this is starting to pick up some steam, and the website is Justice for Cecily, Justice FORCECILY.com, and the Twitter account, the hashtag is Justice Digit for Cecily, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, number 4, C-E-C-I-L-Y. You know, start that with a hashtag. This is starting to get some buzz. Were you there through the trial?
I was there for parts of the trial and as part of the support team. We're very involved in the day-to-day.
Okay, I understand that one of the real travesties, abortions of justice here, was that the trial judge did not allow the jury access to information that might have put this in a context the way you described it to me, but only allowed them to see this very narrow window of this woman, you know, swinging her arm back and hitting a cop in the face. And arguably the jury, therefore, with very specific instructions and limited information, made the decision that, you know, basically the judge defined the decision. Do I have that wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are many instances of, you know, and I think you brought it up exactly right. There was no context for what happened. You know, like we said before, the officers' criminal records of other criminal charges were not allowed in. On the same day as the beginning of the trial, another Occupy protester filed a lawsuit against the same officer for an incident on the same night as the incident with Cecily, for accusing the officer of banging his head on the ground as he dragged him up the stairs of the bus. And none of this was allowed into the court. The accusation that she was beaten and put into a seizure was thrown out as irrelevant, and the defense was not allowed to play any videos because it was deemed by the prosecution and the judge, who are not medical professionals, that she did not have a seizure because they have seen seizures and that was not a real seizure. And as a medical professional, I find it ridiculous that you know, we have this total lack of context, especially regarding very serious medical issues.
You are a medical professional, Frank Coughlin?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Huh. Did she actually have a seizure?
So, I mean, this is the thing with seizures, is that unless you have an MRI, a CAT scan, and an EEG, which is electromagnetic, you're not going to be able to tell that somebody has a seizure. So as a doctor, I would never say that somebody had or did not have a seizure.
Right.
What she had on the ground after having been hit in the head and having seizure-like activity, if she came into my emergency room, I would treat her as if she had a seizure.
Right. But whether she had a seizure or not, she was grabbed by the boob from the back by a guy who wasn't immediately obviously a police officer. She swung her arm around and hit him in the face with her elbow. He apparently sustained a bruise as a consequence of that. And based on this woman is facing 7 years in prison.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point. I mean, the whole thing with not talking about the sexual assault is something that we see so often in patriarchy, and that, you know, women are slut shamed, you know, and this was brought up by the prosecution that, you know, looking at how short her miniskirt was, the fact that she had been.
But Cecily was not wearing a miniskirt, was she?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Cecily was not wearing a miniskirt. I mean, this isn't even an example of classic slut shaming. This is. You know, the judge was not allowing the possibility that there was a sexual crime that precipitated this to be considered as part of the evidence. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are you calling? We have just a minute left. What are people calling for at justiceforcecily.com?
So the website Justice for Cecily will be the home base for all upcoming actions. And right now we are sending out petitions to Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Cuomo to pardon Cecily, as well as letter writing campaigns, other types of petitions, and putting political pressure on Cy Vance, who still can pardon Cecily, as well as other members of the legal system.
Cy Vance is the prosecutor. Cy Vance is the prosecutor.
He is the district attorney.
The district attorney, okay. Frank Coughlin, he's a representative of the Justice for Cecily Support Group. You can read about it, and I encourage you to get over there. Justice for F-O-R, Cecily, CECILY.com. The hashtag justice, number 4, Cecily.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Frank, thanks for being with us. Keep up the great work.
Hey, great. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
some amazing stories here, you know, just amazing stories. A couple of the things that, I'll get to them as we go on through the program. Well, let's pick up some of your phone calls here. Johnny in Vacaville, California. Hey, Johnny, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well, I wanted to talk to you about your comments about the DMV.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to have started a flood of anti-government bureaucracy calls, so I wanted to call in and balance the discussion a bit to point out I had a terrible morning on the phone with business bureaucracies, and they're no more fun. And they're just as screwed up. So,
oh, they're even worse because
we govern ourselves as well as we manage our corporations. So.
Yeah, they're worse. I mean, I have had nightmares with health insurance companies. You know, when 2 years ago, Louise had breast cancer and I had prostate surgery, and between the two of us, we had all these medical bills and things kept falling through the cracks. And you call the insurance companies and they give you these runarounds or you call the doctor's offices, and very often they're at these large practices and you're dealing with, and none of this had to do with the government. These were just all bureaucratic institutions. And the problem is, you know, if I don't like the DMV, if I don't like the government bureaucracy, I can raise hell about it. And there's actually a mechanism for something to be done. These people are civil servants. You know, they can be held accountable. I could say, you know, so-and-so gave me a hard time. Had I got the name of that woman this morning who told me that my credit card account was not a bank account, and therefore I had to go home and get a different kind of bank account, if I wanted to make an issue out of it, which I don't. I mean, she might have actually been right. Who knows? But, you know, there's a mechanism to go after government employees. In fact, there's multiple mechanisms, including, and not the least of which, is going after ultimately their boss and the city council or the mayor's office, raising hell and getting people elected or unelected. But if it's your insurance company or your phone company, you're out of luck. If you're not happy with what they have to say, they just hang up on you.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true.
So it's just...
I just wanted to stick up for this. I don't get... We govern ourselves better. I agree. We govern ourselves better than we manage our corporations.
Well, I can tell you, Medicare and the Veterans Administration, a single-payer healthcare system run by the government and a socialist healthcare system run by the government, Medicare and the Veterans Administration have better customer service ratings, better customer satisfaction ratings, and are more efficient than any for-profit private health insurance company in America. And nobody's disputing those numbers.
Nobody does. So
there's a lot of things government does well. You know, yes, there's always going to be bureaucrats. There's always going to be bureaucracy. And one of the bureaucracies that we all interact with, with the least amount of enthusiasm and the greatest amount of coercion is where we have to personally interact. You know, the IRS, you don't personally go knock on their door, but the one that you have to personally interact with is the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV. And so that's why I think that the Republicans are so enthusiastic about sticking the DMV in between people who want to vote and the ballot box. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Well, the Republicans in the House of Representatives apparently today had a hearing. Today is Wednesday, Had a hearing where they invited the insurance industry executives to come in and tell them what a terrible thing Obamacare was. And looking at Joan McCarter does some great blogs over at Daily Kos. And the headline, I think, says it all. Obamacare enrollment hearing, a total flop for Republicans. Jones says it's not clear what House Republicans thought they would get out of a hearing with health insurance executives Wednesday morning. They apparently intended to prove that Obamacare was failing, but some of the executives have publicly panned Republican efforts to downplay Obamacare enrollments as incredibly rigged, and they've been saying for the last few weeks that people are paying up at a rate of over 80%. But the Republicans went ahead with the hearing, and it was a disaster for them. So much so, some Republican members slinked out of the hearing before it was over. Woohoo! See, this is, you know, I'm waiting for the Benghazi hearings. If I was John Kerry and I was subpoenaed before the Senate to, or before the House to testify about Benghazi, I would say, I'm here and I'm prepared to talk about the one attack on an embassy that we had during the Obama administration and the 13 Benghazis that we had during the Bush administration, the January 22nd, 2002 in Calcutta, India, at the U.S. consulate where five people were killed, the June 14th, 2002 in Karachi, Pakistan, at the U.S. consulate done by al-Qaeda, killing 12 people, injuring 51, the October 12th, 2002 in Indonesia, the February 28th, 2003 in Islamabad, Pakistan, when two people were killed, the May 12th, 2003, all during the Bush administration, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, 36 people killed, including nine Americans. The July 30th, 2004, in Uzbekistan, when two people were killed at the U.S. Embassy during the Bush administration. The December 6th, 2004 attack in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, when nine people were killed during the Bush administration. The March 2nd, 2006, Karachi, Pakistan, suicide bombing. That killed four people, including U.S. diplomat David Foy, who was directly targeted by the attackers. David Foy, he was a diplomat. He was killed during the Bush administration. Where's the outrage? Where's the investigation? September 12, 2006, in Damascus, Syria, four armed gunmen shouting Allah Akbar, killed four people, wounded 13, storming the U.S. embassy with hand grenades. Automatic weapons, a car bomb and a truck bomb. Athens, Greece, January 12, 2007, during the Bush administration. Members of a Greek terrorist group called the Revolutionary Struggle fired a rocket-propelled grenade into the U.S. embassy. March 18, 2008, in Sana'a, Yemen. Members of al-Qaeda fired at the U.S. embassy and hit a nearby school, killing two people. And July 9th, 2008, in Istanbul, Turkey, four armed terrorists attacked the U.S. consulate and killed six people. Oh, and September 17th, 2008, also during the Bush administration in Sana'a, Yemen, terrorists dressed as military officials attacked the U.S. embassy with an arsenal of weapons, including RGPs, and detonated two car bombs. 16 people were killed, including an American student and her husband, who had only been married 3 weeks. Second attack on this embassy in 7 months, all during the Bush administration. I would be glad to discuss any of these, including Benghazi, sir. Which of these 14 attacks would you like to discuss first? 13 during the Bush administration, one during the Obama administration. Well, let's talk about Benghazi! Fox News has I saw the graph the other day. In fact, we showed it on the TV show the night before last. Of mentions, you know, daily mentions over the past, like, few months, 6 months, I think it was, of, and in fact, I think the graph came from MediaMatters.org, on Fox News, of Obamacare. And as Obamacare started becoming successful, the graph started collapsing until there was virtually no mentions of Obamacare. And then Clive and Bundy came along and replaced Obamacare as the number one thing until he made his incredibly, insanely racist and stupid remark. And then he collapsed. And at that point, Fox News had nothing to talk about. And so you see this explosion of discussion about Benghazi. It's like, hey, when there's nothing to talk about Benghazi. Matt in McHenry, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey,
Matt.
Conversation and sort of offer a different perspective.
Okay.
When I was in college, State of Illinois offers a student worker program, so I was able to do that for 3 summers. And a lot of people don't realize is that the DMV doesn't always have the best type of people working for them. The regulars there all had second jobs. It's a very low-paying job.
At least in manager, Illinois.
Yes, at least in Illinois.
Yeah.
My manager, for example, is only making $9 or $10 an hour.
Wow.
It's not like these facilities get a lot of support either. As you said, they're using Internet Explorer. So the computers and the software are very old.
Yeah.
They're flat out inadequate, and they always have to speak with these state servers. So that takes a really long time. And then people have to wait around for this because they're not funded.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to the amount of weight that you had, imagine if you lived a half hour, 40 minutes away, and you were sent away each and every time.
Oh, yeah, I only had to walk a mile each way to, you know, every time I got sent home. So it only took me 15 minutes, you know, to walk home and then 15 minutes to walk back. And so my whole experience only took 3 hours this morning. And each time I only had to wait about 10 or 15 minutes. But, yeah, if I'd, you know, like in Wisconsin, after they passed the voter ID laws, then they started closing down a lot of these rural DMVs, so people would have to drive hours to get an ID.
Yeah, there's only about one DMV in my whole county, so people drive upwards of an hour just to get there.
Wow. 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 I'm telling you, you know, double, triple check if you're going to get ID or a driver's license renewed, but particularly the people who are, you know, newly energized to vote. We've got a very, very important election coming up this fall. And if you live in one of these states where the Republicans have passed these phony baloney voter ID voter suppression laws, check the requirements carefully and bring with you twice as much stuff as you think you're going to need. So anyhow, Matt, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Yeah, it's not like we all love to support the DMV, right? But hey, you know, it's an important government function. We need driver's licenses.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The point I just want to keep coming back to is the same Republicans who use the DMV as the example of the bureaucracy they hate are the ones who want to insert it between people who want to vote and the ballot box. The good, the bad, and the very, very juvenescently ugly. The good. Keith Wright, the New York State Assemblyman, is a member of the bipartisan group of Empire State lawmakers that on Tuesday introduced a resolution into the state legislature urging sports teams with offensive names like Redskins to change their names. Wright and his fellow lawmakers wrote their resolution with the help of Ray Halbritter of the Oneida Indian Nation, who has led the nationwide fight against the Redskins' name. There's absolutely no reason for a team in 2014 or at any time in history, really, to have a name like that. It's just plain racist. Good for Representative Wright and company for helping point that out. The bad. Charles Barkley. During a segment right before last night's broadcast of the San Antonio Spurs, Portland Trail Blazers playoff game, the NBA legend-turned-commentator mocked the women of San Antonio for what he said was their weight problem. Check it out.
I'm telling you, I'm going to get a bunch of churros.
What kind of women are in San Antonio?
Oh, some big old women down there.
Why would you say that?
That's a gold mine for Weight Watchers.
Why does every conversation about San Antonio eventually come around to...
They have spandex in San Antonio?
Oh, no. And Victoria, definitely a secret.
Oh, man.
They can't wear no Victoria's Secret down there. It's a secret.
Yeah, there's really no place for that kind of stuff on TV or anywhere else for that matter. Charles Barkley should be ashamed of himself. And the very, very ugly Steve Hickey. The South Dakota state representative has been embroiled in controversy ever since he wrote a letter to a local newspaper last week saying that gay sex was unnatural because the body is a one-way alley only for the garbage truck to go down. Yeah, he went there. And as if that wasn't bad enough, Hickey doubled the unfortunately named Mr. Hickey, doubled down on his comments on Monday when he sat down for an interview with the editor of the Argus Leader, a major South Dakota newspaper, referencing a letter written by Democratic candidate Dr. Kevin Wyland that criticized his comments. Hickey again tried to make a crude joke about how gay sex was unnatural. Check it out.
And here's what I'd like to ask Dr. Wyland. Mm-hmm. Do you tell your patients to wash their hands before they eat? Why? Because you touch a doorknob and you don't want to get it inside your body. But in here, you know, I hesitate to get crude again, but Dr. Wyland, is it okay for, you know, eight of your friends that you're in love with to take a dump in your bed and you can sleep in it all year long?
I think it would be best for Representative Hickey and the rest of us, for that matter, if he stopped talking about this topic altogether. And maybe he should stop thinking about it so much. That's very, very... This goes back to these homophobes, and this guy I think just I mean, any straight men do not sit around all day long and think about gay sex. I think I can say that as a statement of fact. Which raises the question, if this guy sits around all day long thinking about gay sex, what's going on with this guy? Yeah. So, anyway, back to the calls, as it were. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I don't think about it either, except when it's brought up on TV or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, it's, you gotta wonder about these guys who are professional anti-gay activists. I think that they are either bisexual or gay and afraid to confront it. They're fighting with their own inner demons that if they would just embrace them, they discover they're not even demons. Anyhow, what's up?
Sure. Well, yeah, geez, after the day you've had, I think you need a well-deserved brain.
I walked 6 miles this morning. I walked back and forth, or maybe it was more than that. I mean, whatever it was, I started out with a jacket, and I left the jacket home after the second trip because I was getting so warm from the walk, and then
you've already burned the calories for what you'll do tonight then.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and I had not had breakfast either, and so I came in today and I got 5 pieces of sushi, and normally I give 2 to Jim, and he was not interested in them today, so I ate all 5, but I think I've probably balanced that out with my walking to the DMV.
I guess, yeah.
So what's up?
Well, you know, these Republicans, you know, they keep thinking there's going to be something there at Benghazi. The fact of the matter is, you know, there's no there.
Right.
And the other thing, which is really people have forgotten about, back in 83, didn't we have something go on in Beirut with the bombings under St. Reagan?
Yes, and he turned and ran after a couple hundred of Marines died. Yeah,
which is horrible. And another thing, you know, I think a Republican-led Congress did, maybe you know about this for sure, but did they not cut requested security funds or deny them? That was,
let me give you a verbatim quote. Okay, this is at the top of the democraticunderground.com website today. This is their graphic for the day. They go back to first of all, they show the May 6th 2014 interview with Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz, and he said it doesn't look right. He's talking about Benghazi. Doesn't look right, doesn't smell right. If there's smoke there, we're going to figure out what's going on. We have 4 dead Americans. There's nothing political about this. It's about finding the truth. Okay, that's what he said yesterday. Now, here's what he told CNN back on October 10th, 2012. He was asked the question, is it true that you voted to cut the funding for embassy security? His answer, absolutely. When you're in tough economic times, you have to prioritize things.
Amazing.
Yeah. And the Republicans actually have, in fact, voted numerous times over the last decade to cut embassy security budgets.
I guess they can take their investigation and just turn inward.
This is the thing. If the Democrats wanted to turn it into, wanted to turn it on them, I think that they would have the means to do it. So thanks for calling and raising it, Steve. It's an interesting point, and thanks for watching us in Phoenix there. Patrick in St. Charles, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Patrick, you wanted to respond to my statement about Benghazi?
Good afternoon, Tom. Yes, first, please, with regards to your last caller,
mm-hmm.
In fact, budgets were cut, but at the very same time that Marine detachments were being withdrawn from Libya.
Yeah, in part as a consequence of the Bush privatization plan. They were being replaced with private contractors.
But we moved Benghazi. We moved 3 companies of Marines into Paris, France. Let me figure that part out regarding this administration. 3 companies of Marines were deployed to Paris, France.
What does that have to do with anything?
That means that our Marines were in the wrong place.
Well, these might have been Marines on their way home from Iraq. I mean, at the end of tour of duty.
No, these are embassy, consulate, Marine.
Oh, good. Okay, so you've got a city, Paris, that has, in the last 10 years, had, what, 15, 20, maybe 25 times, where people have been in the streets burning cars, blowing up bombs. You've got a city where they're actually, you know, where a long history of street protests, and they've decided to harden our embassy there. And you're upset about that?
So the anniversary, it's the anniversary of 9/11. It blows my mind. But with regards to Benghazi, unfortunately, sir, you made your comparison between the previous administration and this one, but you lack to advise your audience that Bush and that administration did not say that Al-Qaeda was on the run and that the war was over.
Really?
They admitted.
You ever heard of the USS Abraham Lincoln?
Excuse me?
You ever heard of the USS Abraham Lincoln when Bush flew onto that plane on a jet with a sock stuffed in his pants and got off?
That had to do with being a former Navy. Yes, I do.
Yeah. And he said we have defeated the terrorists
he did not. He said mission accomplished.
No, he never used those words. That's what the banner said.
Just quote mission accomplished.
That's what the banner said.
In any event,
the mission was not accomplished.
Benghazi. Obviously hasn't. The reason that the.
In fact, the mission was a lie. Lie accomplished.
The reason for the persistence is that this administration, in addition to illy affecting the four families of the fallen.
Two of those four families have come out and asked people like you not to make this political. They have specifically asked, and particularly of the Republican Party, please do not politicize the family of Ambassador Stevens and the family of the young man who was working as an independent contractor, who was a former Navy SEAL. They have both explicitly asked Daryl Issa's committee to stop politicizing the deaths of their son and husband, respectively.
That fallen SEAL is a former teammate of mine. And Patricia, his mother, is beside herself with regards to the inactivity and misrepresentation of this administration. And the problem in the investigation is based on not that there was a tragedy in Benghazi that happens during times of war, but that it was the American people were advised something very different than what actually happened. This was not in any way, shape, or form a response to a dumb video.
No, I got that. And that's fine. I don't see why that's.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We know that now. We know that, and everybody's acknowledged that. This is really about trying to dirty up Hillary Clinton. We all. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. We ought to get Ari Ribbenhoff on to talk about the Benghazi hoax. You know, there's to my last caller, if you're seriously considering this issue as a real issue, I would strongly encourage you to pick up a copy. And in fact, I should order one myself because I've had him. We had Ari on as a guest and we've talked about it, but I need to read the book too. It's a short little ebook that you can find over on Amazon, I think, and through MediaMatters.org, called The Benghazi Hoax, and it's 99 cents, and really, really worth checking that thing out. Anyhow, Rick, watching Free Speech TV in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Hey, Rick, you are an Okie from Muskogee.
Yes, sir. Tom, how you doing, buddy?
I'm well. Nice to hear from you. What's up?
Hey, listening to your concerns over your driver's license and wondering if you're familiar with what I refer to as the Carl Miller defense.
No, what's that?
Okay, a simple legal defense that exempts many Americans from even needing a driver's license.
Because?
Okay, we start... It's based on findings from Supreme Court cases.
Right.
Start with one of the biggest ever, Marbury versus Madison. 5 U.S. 37 1803 case, affirmed or verified true, says the Constitution is supreme law of the land.
Right.
Anything in repugnancy is null and void of law. No court has a duty to enforce it. No citizen has the duty to obey it.
Okay. So you're saying that because the requirement for a driver's license is not in the Constitution, that I don't need one?
No, sir. Simpler than that. I'll tell you, Tom, I have about an eighth grade education, and I can follow this legal defense pretty simply.
Mm-hmm.
Takes a few minutes to explain. Okay, after Marbury versus Madison, you take there's over 100 and something Supreme Court cases verifying your right to travel free and unencumbered. Okay?
Right. But traveling and driving a car can be very different things.
Very different things, and that's what comes in play here. All right, then you take Murdoch versus Pennsylvania, 319 U.S. 105, 1943 case, affirmed. And it states, no state can transform a secured liberty into a privilege and issue a license and a fee.
But you're asserting that the right to drive is a right rather than a privilege. And I would say that is not the case. Driving is a privilege. Well, traveling and driving, as I said, are two different things. If I'm a passenger in a car, I don't need a driver's license. If I am operating a 6,000-pound piece of machinery capable of killing people, I need to demonstrate proficiency. What's wrong with that?
Of course. But take it like this. Until you're proven guilty, we're innocent. So I can drive a car until...
Until you're caught driving a car.
No, until someone can prove that I'm not capable of driving a car.
I don't think so. Rick, we're out of time, but we'll have to continue this conversation another time. That's an interesting start. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And he's in Skype. No wonder I didn't see him on the board. And Luke Vargas is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. He's reporting today from where... Where on earth is Luke Vargas today?
No place interesting, just the United Nations today, keeping it straightforward.
Okay, so what's going on in the world, sir?
Well, it depends where you want to start. The United Nations building, as little as the people here have been involved in the Ukrainian crisis, it does seem to be the headline that keeps most people's attention through the day. And the storyline coming out of Moscow today, Wednesday, is that Vladimir Putin this morning said that Russian troops, the sort of 40-odd thousand members of the Russian armed forces who were stationed near the Ukrainian border, had withdrawn, not fully, all the way back into central Russia, but somewhere further back. He didn't exactly say where they'd gone, only saying they had gone back to their regular training facilities. And then he actually urged the U.S. Implicitly and Western powers like NATO, who have been conducting satellite overflights of the region, to find out themselves, to use their technological eyes in the sky to figure out where the Russian troops had been. So it seems like somewhat of a concession by Vladimir Putin today. He also called on separatists in the city of Donetsk to postpone the referendum they had planned for Sunday, in which people in the town were going to vote whether or not they wanted to secede from Ukraine and perhaps join the Russian Federation. So we'll see if there's any response to that. You know, the Kremlin has said it does not give orders to the people who are occupying government buildings in Donetsk. So I think it remains a question whether or not they'll want to listen to what Vladimir Putin says.
Now, has there been
at least the news from today?
You know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, when George Herbert Walker Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev negotiated the unraveling of the Soviet Union, part of that agreement was that NATO would never invite into its sphere of influence or directly involve itself with the Baltic states and the states directly abutting the Soviet Union or Russia, specifically Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine. And Bill Clinton broke that deal. He got Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia into NATO, or at least partway into NATO. And now this deal that was offered by the EU that was originally turned down, and then the government got thrown out, and the new government, unelected government Ukraine wants to take, has a NATO provision built into it. I would think that if the Chinese were cutting mutual defense contracts with Canada or with Mexico, we'd be pretty flipped out. Has NATO or the United States said, okay, cool, you pull your troops back, we're going to pull our troops back?
No, we haven't seen that kind of exchange. And as you mentioned, U.S. troops acting very clearly to try to back up NATO and get NATO at least tangentially involved in the Ukrainian crisis. You know, we've put troops in, I think it's four countries now, 600 across Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Poland. So even though NATO is not, you know, sending troops right to Ukraine, we are doing, and NATO is doing, you know, the closest it can do to that, possibly.
Right.
But I have not heard.
Gorbachev had made it very clear, you know, and Poland in particular was the deal breaker. And then when George W. Bush was talking about citing NATO missiles in Poland, and back when Putin was president then, and Putin said, you know, that's going to be a real problem, and that. Ultimately, George W. Bush backed off, but the Obama administration seems to be they're not moving forward with the missiles, as far as I know. But it seems to me that you know, there's a good piece in the New York Times about how a bunch of German politicians, like, you know, the two former prime ministers of Germany, are both pointing out how NATO has basically screwed Russia. And, you know, on this deal, and nobody's talking about it. I was in Germany a couple of weeks ago, and I was reading about this in the newspapers, and I'm like, why am I not reading about this in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole new host of European leaders who are trying to take over a bigger and bigger foreign policy stance. You need look no further than Poland, where you've seen Foreign Minister Sikorski, you know, take on a huge role, basically injecting Poland into the Ukrainian crisis at a very, you know, prominent position, trying to steer NATO and European policy on this. So, you know, perhaps the capitals that used to sort of be in charge of keeping up these agreements are really no longer the most relevant, or at least in the case of the court of public opinion, the most vocal advocates for pursuing any given policy. Poland, again, and Lithuanian foreign minister have been using social media very actively to try and rally opinion and support for their sort of more aggressive posture that they're seeking against Russia. And again, you know, they may be the ones calling the shots more and more these days.
I'm curious about your thoughts on Nouriel Roubini wrote a piece for his blog, Eco Monitor, day before yesterday. He says the biggest geopolitical risk of our times is not the conflict between Israel and Iran over nuclear proliferations. It's not the chronic disorder in Maghreb and the Hindu Kush. It is not the risk of Cold War II between Russia and the West over Ukraine. All of these are serious, but none is as serious as the challenge of sustaining the peaceful character of China's rise. That's why it's particularly disturbing to hear Japan and Chinese officials and analysts compare the country's bilateral relationship to that between Britain and Germany on the eve of World War I. What's going on there?
Hey, headlines relevant to this have sprouted up today. We had reports earlier this morning from the Vietnamese government saying that a Chinese vessel had deliberately rammed into two Vietnamese naval vessels in the South China Sea. The reason, you know, obviously we've had tensions in the South China Sea for a long time, particularly with respect to China's assertion of where it has territorial control. Right. What had happened in recent days is that the Chinese state oil company had moved a massive drilling rig into these waters that Vietnam claims. And in response, the Vietnamese Navy mobilized just a number of ships to go out there and monitor what was happening. And it led, there are conflicting accounts about how actually things got underway today, but the firing of water cannons by the Chinese vessels. It's worth noting, you know, so many people write off what these neighbors of China can do in response to this. And it is a good point that they have so much financial stake, but the Philippines are taking China to a court in The Hague, and we'll see if Vietnam wants to follow in their footsteps here.
Wow. Yeah. And if Japan, I mean, this dispute over the islands, this is some spooky stuff. And oil seems to be at the center of much of it. Thank you very much. Great to hear from you today.
Sure thing,
Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's been an interesting day. We started out with Justice for Cecily. This is really worth checking out. Justice, F-O-R, Cecily, C-E-C-I-L-Y.com. And the Twitter account is hashtag Justice Digit 4, Justice 4, the number 4, Cecily, C-E-C-I-L-Y, about this woman who was groped by a cop. She swung her leg or her elbow back and hit him in the face, and she just was convicted to 7 years in prison for doing that because he grabbed her breast. This is just astounding. And, of course, in our first hour, we were talking about the DMV and why the Republicans want to put the DMV between you and your vote. Right now, Alec Lors is with us. He is the founder of the I Matter campaign, I Matter Youth, the letter I, followed by the words matter and youth, matteryouth.org. And Alex, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's good to be back.
So the last time you were with us, and I don't recall if you were here on radio or on TV, you were telling us, correct me if I'm wrong on this, maybe I'm even misremembering, but you were telling us about a lawsuit on behalf of the youth of the world about global warming.
Well, yeah. Basically, it's at this point, it's on behalf of the U.S. youth, pretty much just standing up for our planet, saying that we don't want the government to keep allowing the fossil fuel industry to take advantage of our future, of our basically the planet we depend on for life, because they actually have a legal obligation to protect natural resources for future generations under the public trust doctrine and commons law and these really well-founded legal doctrines.
They being whom?
The U.S. government. Every sovereign state, as one of the aspects of sovereignty, has to agree to basically, to some extent, protect navigable waters and land and forests and things
and
like that.
And is this under United Nations agreement, or is this, where do we find this law?
I'm completely clear about the actual legality of it. All I know is that basically the public trust doctrine states that we have to keep these resources in common for future generations, basically as beneficiaries of this trust.
Right.
And we, as young people, as the youngest generation, are basically standing on behalf of those future stakeholders, the ones who will basically have to inherit the planet that we create over the course of our generation's lifetime. And basically, I feel like the way that our system is structured right now doesn't allow for people to be connected with each other, to be connected with nature, and it leads to problems from climate change to war to poverty. I really think that they're all symptoms of the same sickness in the way that we think. And I really feel like attacking, or not attacking, but trying to heal this sickness comes down to taking action in all the levels of basically society that we can, from our own personal relationships to schools, to institutions, to ultimately the government. And over the course of my work, I've found that, or I've begun to consider the possibility that the legal world is basically the way into these really bureaucratic governmental systems. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're working with a group of really good lawyers who have been working on this legal doctrine called atmospheric trust litigation. And we're basically asking that the U.S. government develop a plan to reduce carbon emissions 6% per year beginning now, basically, which is what the science says needs to happen if we are to
avoid disaster.
Avoid disaster, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And who is the litigant?
You mean who's filing the case?
Yeah. On who? Yeah.
Basically, I and four other young people are the plaintiffs in the federal lawsuit. We also have cases were filed in all 50 states a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and one or two of those are still active. But for the most part, the federal case has gone through a lot of ups and downs over the past couple of years. It was after a year of deliberation. Following the initial hearing, the case was dismissed. But
was that on the basis of a lack of standing or a lack of specific case law that was being violated? Yeah, what was the basis for the dismissal?
Well, it was. I mean, the manufacturing and trucking industries actually intervened in the case to fight us, essentially. And they pretty much sent a team of really good lawyers just to find any loophole that they could in our argument and basically just resort to legal quibbles about who has a jurisdiction for this or what the right jargon is for that. And it basically just the moral issue wasn't allowed to be made at all. I mean, Dr. James Hansen, one of the world's top climate scientists, was ready to testify at the hearing on behalf of his grandchildren, but the court wouldn't allow the climate change point to be made at all. They basically just resorted to just picking apart the language of the, you know, the legal.
Have things gotten better since then?
They have. We filed a motion we filed an appeal, and that has taken until this week to be heard.
Which court?
In the Court of Appeals in Washington D.C.
So the D.C. Circuit Court, the D.C. Appeals Court.
Yeah, and it's we were supposed to have an oral argument last Friday or last week sometime, but that was canceled. For some reason, they basically just didn't want the constituents in this case, the young people who are ready to come to the court and basically show their faces to the,
what's going to happen?
So the judges deliberated on their own in private on Friday.
And you mean just based on front of the court briefs?
Pretty much based on all of the, various documents that we've, filed. There's, amicus curiae briefs that, some scientists filed. There's a lot of documents that have been submitted, but basically just culminating or going through all of that and making a decision. So we're currently in the process of just sort of waiting for that to come in. But I personally feel hopeful. There's honestly no way to be able to tell at this point what the outcome will be.
Have any state courts ruled in your favor?
A couple of them have made it pretty far in the process at this point. The problem is that the entire process is so slow that it's hard to get any sort of outcome quickly. But a couple of the courts did.
Oh, I think your Skype just froze. Yeah, we just lost the signal. This is the one of the problems with this wonderful new technology. Oh, he's back?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You're back.
Did it go out?
Yeah, it froze up there for a minute. So I was asking state courts, any success? We have about a half a minute left.
Okay. I mean, for the most part, most of them were dismissed just on the premise that we didn't have, I don't know, I'm not completely sure about why they were all dismissed, but the federal case is still alive, and the important point to make is that we're going to continue fighting no matter what happens.
There you go. Okay. Alec Lures, he's the founder of the I Matter campaign, the website imatteryouth.org, the letter I, matteryouth.org. And Alec, thank you for dropping by, Alec.
Yeah, thank you.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So should, what would be the, if you wanted to try to use the court system to stop the fossil fuel industry, what would be the way to do it? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Stephen Colbert going off on how the Satanists are building this statue. We actually had them on our show. Norma in Montgomery, speaking of Alabama, Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to you earlier talking about your battle with getting your driver's license.
Right.
And I was wondering, does your driver's license have a gold star on it?
The person, what they gave me today was a piece of paper, which is a temporary driver's license, good for 3 months. And he said that within the next few weeks, I would get one. I would get my driver's license in the mail, and that in fact it would have a gold star, meaning that it is a what do they call it, real ID or something?
Yeah, it's a certified ID that will allow you to get onto an airplane.
Right.
A lot of people in Alabama don't know this is being done, but. Tom, in establishing your ID, what is the first piece of paper that you have to prove that you are a human being?
Your birth certificate.
Right. All right. If a state that has not accepted the Affordable Care Act or expanded Medicaid has a problem with for-profit hospitals closing and a woman has to drive hours to get to a hospital to deliver birth, and she doesn't make it and gives birth on the side of the highway, how does she get a birth certificate for this child and prove it's hers?
Well, having delivered our second child at home, Louise and I did it. We had a friend who was sort of a midwife. She'd been to about a dozen births, I think. And we had a friend who was a MD who was just a mile or so away on call.
But we
did a home birth, and I can tell you just from experience, and then our third child we delivered in a birthing center, which was not a hospital, me and a midwife. But in particular with our second child, I went down to the county courthouse and filed the birth certificate. You walk in and you say, we had a home birth or we had a birth by the side of the road. And I will swear to that in front of a notary, and they give you a birth certificate. Or at least they did. I mean, this was 35 years ago, right? I don't know how it works now.
Now, let's say your birth certificate also requires that you have the footprints on the back of it, and you have to take the baby.
I think those are more souvenirs. I remember the old footprint ones from, like, there used to be one on mine, and I think that was just a souvenir thing that the hospital gave out, and I'm not even sure it was a real footprint of the real baby, although maybe it was.
Yeah, but if you have to go in and prove that you gave birth to this child and it is your child in the county health department or whatever to get a birth certificate, then it makes it more difficult to get a Social Security card for this child so when he starts school you can prove who he is.
Right.
And then later on when he wants to get a driver's license or an ID, it makes it even harder.
Yep.
And so if you have four different hospitals in different areas of the state without the Affordable Care Act closing, it makes it very difficult for poor people living in rural areas to go in and prove who they are, prove who their child is.
So your point is that the lack of expansion of the Affordable Care Act adds to the bureaucratic nightmare or the difficulties in getting the ID necessary to vote in those states where you've got Republican voter suppression laws going into effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent point. Thank you. I'm sorry I wandered off into all the minutia there. You're absolutely right. I agree with you. Good point. Well made. Thank you. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul Loeb, an old friend and social activist, author of numerous books, including the just released, re-released, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. He also wrote Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times as well. Website paulloeb, L-O-E-B .org is on the line with us. Hey, Paul, welcome back to the program.
It's so good to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked. I hope all is well with you and your family and all the work that you're doing.
It is. I had too much work, but that's chronic.
So yeah, well, yeah.
It's when you're doing the good work.
That's our lives. So tell me about the re-release here. The Impossible will take a little while.
Well, basically, The Impossible came out originally in 2004 and actually did pretty well. It was on the bestseller list of the independent bookstores for about 11 weeks. And then publisher ran out over the holidays. That kind of broke the momentum. And it's been in print ever since. I think there's 23, 24 printings. But what it seemed to me is that after a decade, that it was just time to update the book. And in some ways, it's a book on political hope with all sorts of amazing authors, and Nelson Mandela and Alice Walker and Jim Wallace and Paul Hawken and Wendell Berry and just Bill McKibben's in there. And what I wanted to do is to bring it up to date for this current time, because in some ways, when it came out, certainly a lot of people I knew were feeling pretty bleak. But in other ways, this is almost a harder time because you had this sort of rise of hopes of a lot of people for Obama, and then suddenly the change a lot of people hoped for didn't occur. You see the steady march of climate change, the widening inequality. I mean, we don't need to go into all the issues, but it's a difficult time. And so to my mind, it just seemed like it was useful to bring in some new stories of people talking about doing the impossible. And the original edition, I had a lot of examples from, I guess I would call it the most difficult situations one could imagine. So what did it take for Nelson Mandela and his compatriots to be there in that Robben Island prison and yet maintain hope? What was it like for Václav Havel and his compatriots in Czechoslovakia? What was it like for the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina? What was it like here in the U.S. in the sort of most viciously violent years of the civil rights movement? So I had a lot of those kinds of examples because I always feel like when people say, oh, there's nothing I can do or it's too hard, one of my responses is, well, yeah, it's difficult, but are you really saying it's more difficult than it was in apartheid South Africa or the communist dictatorships in Eastern Europe or any of the other kind of really difficult situations? Mm. And so that was always the core of the book. But now I've sort of added new, more recent examples. So you look at the Arab Spring, and you could say certainly things are they're not real pretty right now. I mean, at least in Egypt, it's pretty ugly. But I remember interviewing. I have a couple very, very powerful stories, and the new version of The Impossible will take a little while, from the Arab Spring. And I remember talking with a young Egyptian woman who I met at one of the colleges where I was speaking last fall, and she said, yeah, it's hard, and it's not exactly the way people wanted to see it turn out, but that there was a whole generation that learned courage and a whole generation that learned to stand up, and that they were simply not going to forget that. And at that point, they'd overthrown two dictators, and they were ready to continue and overthrow a third if need be. And so part of the challenge of when you do a book about political hope is you don't want it to be naive and you don't want it to be sentimental and sort of like, oh, let's just all wish for unicorns and everything will be wonderful. This is a messy, at some points pretty cruel world with huge institutions of power that we're up against. And so you want to be realistic in saying, yep, this is what we're against. This is what we have to change. This is the magnitude of it. And yet people have done it in other times. So one of the favorite pieces that I added was a piece of Bill Moyers about the populists and the progressives, and at a period when it just looked like the Gilded Age robber barons had just a lockdown on the American politics. And yet somehow people were able to overcome it. You know, is it exactly the same as now? Well, of course not. But at the same time, you have
Somehow. I mean, it was the crash of 1896.
But it was also the persistence of all those other movements.
Sure.
That extended, up through the New Deal, that where people were keeping on. And when something happens like a crash, suddenly there are people out there. They're talking.
Then there's a galvanizing instance.
There's a galvanizing instance, exactly. And there's connectivity instead of isolation.
Right.
And part of the challenge is, it's not to say that, I mean, if you look at the polls, most people acknowledge that we're in a mess. The question is, do they feel they can do anything about it? And are they in the kinds of situation. There's an actual organizing going on where people are talking to each other where they feel, oh, yes, we can try this. And you never know what's going to happen. I mean, I was stunned. I guess this is late yesterday it broke. 32 years ago, I was kicked out of Stanford University for anti-war activism, and Stanford just agreed to divest from coal. And people can say, oh, it's no big deal or it's only partial, but that's huge. And that was entirely due to a movement of the students on the campus pushing for it.
Right.
And so, you know, so you look at it, one of the things that happens, I think, is that we sort of exceptionalize our successes and say, oh, well, that doesn't really matter. So I've got some sections in the new version of The Impossible. We'll take a little while on the gay rights movement. And it's easy to say, oh, well, that was just inevitable and it was foreordained. But certainly 30, 40 years ago, if you were speaking
out, or for the last 7,000 years.
Or for the last 7,000 years, it hardly seemed safe or costless or foreordained.
Right.
Which is not to say that it's, you know, that the battle is entirely fought, but it's so easy for us to be able to sort of dismiss our victories. And part of what I like, the phrase I use was two phrases. One is Nelson Mandela talks about the multiplication of courage. Phrase I really like. One person can be inspired by a completely different movement in a completely different historical time to do something where they happen to be. The other notion is that that I came up with is that these kinds of successes are transferable. So that is, you can take a lesson, and it may be from a nonviolent struggle of 50 or 100 years ago, you can use that to today. You can transfer a movement against inequality and use its lessons in terms of climate change. You can look at the civil rights movement and draw hope from its persistence. So part of what I think people need to do is to be able to get past that isolation.
There
That's
you go.
What The Impossible is about.
Paul Loeb, he's the author of a whole bunch of really great books. Soul of a Citizen is a classic, but his new book, or his book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, has been updated and reissued. It's just out now. Check it out. The Impossible Will Take a Little While. You can check it out at his website, Paul Loeb, LOEB.org. Thanks, Paul.
We're the Impossible, not at work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your thoughts on my thoughts on it. Right after this. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And C-Money in Williston, North Dakota. Hey, C-Money, what's up? No? Can't hear? Wait. Is there somebody there? Apparently not. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm sorry I missed you last week. I was crazy getting. We didn't think we were going to be able to make it from all the way out here, and traffic was a nightmare. And of course, everything going on downtown. So I didn't.
Well, life goes on.
Didn't make it.
Next time.
Yeah, next time we'll try. But listen, I'm going to talk about this the global warming report that the right is trying to pillory, and of course saying it's a big distraction from Benghazi. But I think we're not only dealing with denial here, but ignorance. I got to tell you, there's a local conservative guy that I talk to sometimes, and I tried this. I said, okay, what happens to all the carbon dioxide when you burn 100 million barrels of oil a day plus coal? And he laughed at me, and he said, Paul, it evaporates out into space.
Really?
And he said, yeah, that's what he said. And he said, I'm surprised you don't know that, as intelligent of a guy as you are. And I said, it evaporates out. What prevents the rest of the atmosphere from evaporating out into space?
Right.
And he said, you know, well, you change the subject. All your little twists and turns are all very clever, but, you know, it's really not relevant. And then he hung up on me. This was a while ago.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, let's try a different tack. Forget the greenhouse gases. Tom, I know you know this one. The question is, where does all the heat go? Forget the greenhouse gases.
Right.
What about the heat when I called the show today, this morning, and I asked, I was talking to the producer, and I said, so you drive to the studio, you get out of your car, look at your engine block. It's piping hot. You couldn't touch it. But when you come out of the show, it's cooled off, right? Where did all the heat go?
Right.
And he said, it cooled off. I said, but where'd the heat go? He says, look, there's hot and there's cold. And I said, no, there's only heat. There's not, cold is not a thing.
Right.
Cold is just a lack of heat.
Cold is like black. It's not a color. It's
right. So where did the heat go? And I tried to explain that the heat that you're – he said that all of this, is the climate change is from the sun. I said, right. But it's the sun energy that you – this that was stored as fossil fuel, and now you're turning up the sun.
Right.
When you start burning
it's
a lot of –
it's 300 million-year-old sunlight.
Exactly.
Thus the title of my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
Yeah, that's why I knew that. That's why I knew that you know where I was going with this. But that seems to be not. They're okay with the idea that if the sun gets hotter, we'll get, you know, the Earth will warm up.
Right.
But they're not okay with the idea that if you turn the sun up by using, you know, energy that was stored, it's going to warm up.
It's bizarre.
Go into a lighting store. Is it warm in there with all the lights on?
Right.
Yeah, because there's too many lights on.
Yeah, yeah.
What
you're illustrating, Paul, is the, you know, I had this debate on TV last night, and afterwards I was sitting around with Andrew and Nate and Kurt, our producers, and Wendy and Sonny, the director and graphics person, and it had turned into a debate about climate change. I mean, you know, I just brought the study up, and we had one progressive and two conservatives on, and the two conservatives are both saying there's no such thing. And one of them even went so far as to say, you know, we had the little warm, little ice age, and we had the warming period. And I'm like, those were regional. And he's like, no, they weren't. And he's like, you know what percentage of carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere? And I said, it's like below 0.1. And he's like, it's 0.3%. And he said, you know how much we've added to the atmosphere since 1850? And I said, I don't know. And he said, it's 3%. And he says, so 3% of 0.03%, and you're worried about that? And I'm like, yeah, you know, sometimes very small amounts of little things. I mean, you know, I could give you 25,000ths of 1 milligram of lysergic acid diethylamide, and you would notice a change in your consciousness. I didn't say that one, but it occurred to me to say.
They wouldn't.
Yeah,
they wouldn't. That's because they're already tripping.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But I mean, the point is that you know, I ultimately said to him, Michael, I wouldn't try to play a scientist on TV. They've got these talking points that they really believe that are coming out of the same think tanks, and in many cases, the exact same scientists who 30 years ago were telling us that tobacco doesn't cause lung cancer, or if does, you can't. You can't make a direct association. It's only an inferential association. And, you know, we kind of blew that one up, and we're blowing this one up now. But it's like the big question, and there was a good piece about this in the New York Times over the weekend or over the last couple of days. It was their one of the top 10 forwarded stories yesterday, so it was probably a 2 or 3 day old story. I read it in the phone on my iPhone and sitting on the subway on the way over to the TV studio. Was how America, the United States of America, is the only developed country in the world where there's not an absolute consensus, consensus is the wrong word, but an absolute majority opinion that not only is climate change real and not only is it caused by human beings, but it's a crisis. And the reason why, of course, they didn't get into this in the New York Times article, which I thought I was very disappointed by, is because you've got, you know, some billionaire oil magnates like the Koch brothers, and you've got, you know, multi-billion, $100 billion value companies like ExxonMobil that literally have spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to propagandize us and who buy politicians who will spout this line. I mean, not a single Republican freshman member of Congress in the last election was willing to acknowledge that global climate change was real and caused by humans. Not one. Not one.
Well, they also use evidence of a problem as evidence of that there's not a problem. And one of them, we always hear that the polar caps, the South Pole is actually growing.
Yeah.
And there was a story a couple of months ago about a ship that had gone down that got caught in the ice.
Yeah.
And what happens is, the glaciers melt. And this what happens is the melted fresh water spreads out across the in a layer of, you know, across it gets wider, but the fresh water sits on top of the seawater because it's less dense,
right?
And then it refreezes,
right?
So it looks like it's wider, but then see, it melts again,
right?
And so what's happening is, and if the other thing is, if the glacier was, if it actually was growing, you'd start to ask, well, wait a minute, then where's all the fresh water coming from?
Right.
Because only fresh water freezes.
Some of it's coming out of the atmosphere. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I believe that because there's 5% more moisture in the atmosphere now than there was
condensed,
50. Yeah. That you've got actually more snow events happening over Antarctica right now than there were before.
Yeah, and the problem is that they think ice is ice. Well, no, glacial ice is very, very dense because of all the pressure.
Right.
So when it melts and this reformation of ice, this is just icebox ice. It's out of your freezer.
Yeah.
It's not, and so it looks like it's bigger at points, like when the icebreakers got stuck because they got stuck in a freshwater. I don't know what you call it, but when there's a big plane of fresh water sitting on top of the seawater, and then it can refreeze.
Right, and fresh water freezes at 31, 32. Seawater freezes at lower temperature than that, if at all.
But yeah, well, the salt doesn't freeze
into
it.
The salt precipitates out, yeah.
Yeah, so it has to.
Yeah. So,
but
we're blithering here.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but the problem is we've got denial and ignorance at the same time.
I know.
And
well, I see, they usually go hand in hand.
Well, that is true. But, the problem is that when you think about it, they have to deny it and make it a political issue because if they were to say, oh, yeah, there is a problem, that would mean they would be compelled to have to do something about it.
Right, right. And the doing something about it could reboot our – this is the amazing thing. We could reboot our economy. We could have a new industrial revolution in the United States – based on solar energy and wind energy. We could reinvent the world anew. There's so much positive stuff that could be happening all over the world if it wasn't for the fact that the fossil fuel industry is sitting on 2.5-3 trillion tons of carbon that they have put on their balance sheet representing trillions of dollars, and they want to get that stuff out of the ground and turn it into cash. And that's what's really going on. And if they do, it'll destroy the world. Paul, I got to run. I got to take some more calls, but thank you for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Jim in Chillicothe, Illinois. Chillicothe. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, I'm your 20-year lung cancer survivor.
Oh, good on you, Jim.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I was watching the Science Channel, and they had a documentary on that NASA released. Because of the Freedom of Information Act, that there's a hole in the sun.
Are you talking about sunspots?
No, an actual hole in the sun.
Huh.
They don't know. They can't. They have two theories of how it got there. The good aliens put it there to help us with our climate change.
Right.
And the other possibility is a porthole to another galaxy. But
Jim, did you just read this on the internet?
Excuse me?
Did you read this on the internet, or did a pigeon tell you about this?
No, it was on the Science Channel.
Oh, really?
On TV.
Huh.
Well, you won't hear about that on Fox or CBS, ABC, NBC.
No, I haven't. I know that there are holes in the sun. I mean, there's sunspots. That's, you know, and the sun is really just a giant ball of gas, you know. It's mostly hydrogen, you know, fusing. Hydrogen and helium engaged in a giant thermonuclear fusion reaction. But although there are heavier elements as you go in toward the core of the sun, as I recall, because when suns explode, finally, that's the Earth. Every element around us is a dead star.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which is pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. Everything you see around you came about as the result of the death of a star. But hole in the sun? No, I didn't know about that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I have to give in to a momentary curiosity and see what's at the top of the Drudge Report. Feds warn Drudge faces regulation. Oh, jeez. Okay. So Matt Drudge now is saying that he's going to be the victim of something. Oh, my. What can you say? What can you do? Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You wanted to talk about Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, I got a question for you. This might not be fair because I know the answer, but when Jimmy Carter left office, what was the national debt?
My recollection is it was in the neighborhood of $800 billion.
correct. I'll tell you what, you're unbelievable.
Well, I remember that because when Reagan left office, it was just under $3 trillion. It was like 2.7 or something like that. And Reagan had basically tripled the national debt. And I remember that because throughout Reagan's presidency, we had a horrible recession. We had terrible unemployment. We had awful inflation to start the thing out. But toward the end, the economy was starting to look pretty good, and people were going around looking, saying, "No, that Ronald Reagan, he sure did fix the economy." And my response was always, "Give me a $3 trillion credit card, and I'll show you what it looks like to live large," or a $2 trillion credit card. He was adding on to the debt that preceded it. And in fact, Ronald Reagan borrowed more money during his 8 years than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. And
you know, the thing about it is you stop to think that we fought two world wars, we fought the Cold War.
The Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812.
We went to the moon.
Yep.
And we
built a middle class and we put...
All happened before Reagan came around.
That's right. And it all happened generating less debt than Reagan ran up in his 8 years. Most of which, or much of which, at least $1 trillion of which he borrowed that actually did not go into the productive economy. It went to the military-industrial complex for his Star Wars project and his other bizarre things. You know, those were really dark days in American history, and that's why there's this Reagan legacy project that the Republican Party put together about 5 years after Reagan's presidency was over. They realized that the polls showed that Reagan was really one of the least popular contemporary American presidents. People did not remember him well. And people who were alive and knew his presidency didn't think very well of it. And so they put together this project to try and name a building after Ronald Reagan in every single county in the United States. And they're about 90% of the way there. And to try and reinvent the history of Reagan, to retell his story. And there's a great book that pushes back on that called Tear Down This Myth. I forget the author's name, but it's just a brilliant book that documents, all the mythology and lies that have been told about Reagan since his presidency. But he had more people.
Tom, I think Adolf Hitler said, if you tell a lie often enough, it becomes the truth.
Yeah, if it's big enough and you tell it often enough. That was Joe Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister. And Reagan, the Reagan administration is the administration. And we look back at Teapot Dome and all these other, scandal-filled administrations, the Nixon administration. More people, more senior administration officials were arrested, convicted of high crimes, of major felonies during the Reagan administration than any other administration in the history of the United States. It took a pardon by Herbert Walker Bush to put an end to it. Thank you, Howard. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to share with everybody that when I went to vote in the primaries, they were offering no-fee ID cards, but you had to say that you didn't have an ID.
Right.
And I don't know if they're going to do that again in the full election, but I took a picture of it when I was voting, and I just put it on your Facebook page.
Oh, cool.
For those in North Carolina, if you need an ID, you can get a free one, but you do still have to submit proof of Social Security, proof of residence, and proof of age and identity.
Right, so you got to do that song and dance that I had to do this morning at the DMV.
Right, but it's free, yeah. But you have to go vote to get it, so that's kind of...
That's
a good way to get people to go vote. Is kind of,
well, that's
not what they had in mind, but
that's,
you have to go vote and get a paper from them that says that it's for voting purposes.
Right.
For it to be free.
Very interesting.
So
Marcia,
doing it again in November.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. And thank you for the information. It's always great to hear from you, Marcia. Yeah, Dwayne in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hey, I listening to the Jay Inslee's cap and trade.
Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State.
Yeah, whenever I do that, whenever I hear about that, I it's great that he's speaking in favor of doing something about the climate.
Right.
But the Democrats, when they back this cap and trade, they should realize they're going to be driving up the price of the energy, And if they just give it all the money they collect, it's an indirect tax. If they give it to traders instead of returning it to the public, they're eventually going to lose support. And I don't know why the Democrats aren't seriously involved in the cap and dividend programs instead of this cap and trade.
Or it's called fee and dividend, yes. Basically, or a tax and dividend. And for people who don't know what you're talking about, Duane, let me just explain real quickly, and you can correct me if I get any of this wrong. Back during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, acid rain had become a crisis in the United States and around the world. It was eating up monuments all over the planet, and it was because, you know, our population had doubled and doubled again over the last 60 years and the Industrial Revolution and all that stuff, and we were throwing all the sulfur dioxide into the air, which was forming sulfuric acid in the upper atmosphere and coming down with the rain and dissolving and pretty much anything made out of limestone and dissolving paint off cars. And so George Herbert Walker Bush in the United States did what the European Union did in Europe, and that was created a cap and trade program for sulfur dioxide. So they said to the power plants, you can emit a certain amount of sulfur dioxide, and beyond that, you have to pay a certain amount. And the various power plants could trade these credits back and forth. And over time, the cap declined. And that program is still in place. And it successfully got the acid rain, got the sulfur dioxide out of the atmosphere. Acid rain is no longer a problem. And our rivers are back to being alive and stuff like that. And so what Jay Inslee wants to do, the governor of Washington State, is something very much like that in Washington State. And it's one of many proposals to reduce carbon dioxide. Only he wants to do it with carbon dioxide instead of with sulfur dioxide. And what you're suggesting, which I am an advocate of, is instead of cap and trade, because the trading, then you end up with a marketplace, a secondary marketplace for the trading, and the banksters get into it, and they end up making most of the money on it. Instead of doing cap and trade, what you do is you say, okay, the cost of carbon is $100 a ton, for example, and we're going to collect that money, and then we're going to redistribute that money back to the people the same way that the Alaska Permanent Fund works. So, you know, every year, Sarah Palin wrote a check for roughly $2,000 to every man, woman, and child in Alaska. And this has been going on since the 70s, and it continues to happen. And so basically what Alaska has now is a guaranteed minimum income for a family of five, about $10,000 a year. And you know, some years it's a little more, some years it's a little less. And you could do the same thing by charging a tax on carbon, or a fee, if you want to call it that, not use the dirty word tax, and then rebate 100% of it to the people so that they can deal with the increased cost of gasoline, the increased cost of transportation and other things. And so therefore, the only effect really of this, rather than hurting the average consumer, the only effect of this is that suddenly alternative forms of energy are less expensive than fossil fuel-based forms of energy, and you see a natural and fairly rapid shift in technology and in the economy. So have I done a good job of explaining that, Duane?
Perfect.
Okay, good. I'm with you. I like Jay Inslee. I actually, Louise and I had dinner with him many years ago when he was just a congressman, and I think he's a very, very smart guy. And if he thinks cap and trade can get through, it's better than nothing, but fee and rebate is absolutely the best way to go. Duane, thanks a lot for the call. Jake in Chicago. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. You know, you asked about how you could take the oil companies and so forth to court. I think that and this might be something that you'd want to work on as a project since you have the voice. We have to be very drastic with respect to the fossil fuel companies and these assets they have on their balance sheet, because the, you know, environmental scientists tell us that of the stuff that they already own or control, they 80% of that, or whatever the number, some very high number like that, has to stay in the ground in order to not bust through this two degree cap that the scientists tell us we have.
Right.
And the taxing is one way of doing it. But I think that we're going to have to do something a lot more major than simply taxing it.
Yeah, and the big challenge is then you get the stockholders of ExxonMobil, who are not inconsequential, or the BP or Shell or you know, Gazprom, I fill in the blank, coming to us saying, wait a minute, we've got something, you know, we've invested our life savings, we've invested our money, we've invested our fortunes in this oil company and or this coal company, Peabody or whatever, and now you're telling us we cannot realize a return on that investment. We, you know, that suddenly our Enron stock, not Enron, our ExxonMobil stock, you know, that was worth $100 a share is now worth $10 a share, really? And as a society, we have to figure out how to deal with that, Jake. And I think that the way to deal with it is to say, hey, you know, there used to be companies that made buggy whips. And they had stockholders. And their stockholders got screwed. Welcome to the new world. That said, don't forget, democracy begins with you. We'll see you tomorrow. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.